The 90s, a golden time for Serie A. The greatest, most glamorous players in the world bestriding the pitches of the peninsula. Today's show focuses, though, on a man who was in no way glamorous, in no way grand, but who had perhaps the most remarkable story of them all.
Per lui, 60.000 spettatori a San Siro, per Ronaldinho, per l'Inter, per capire se le turbulenze in casa nell'Azzurra scompaiono dinanzi al Brescia.
Yes, listeners, it's the 31st of August 1997, and while a new Serie A season is about to get underway, Italy's attention is focused on San Siro, where Ronaldo, or Fenomeno, is about to make his debut for Inter against Brescia. Now, popularly, the story is that the show was stolen that day by his fellow Inter debutant, Alvaro Recoba, and his brace. But there was another scene stealer. The man whose goal on the 73rd minute had left Ronaldo and Recoba and the rest of the Inter bunch trailing to newly promoted Brescia. It is Dario Hübner. And my word, a Golazzo appreciation of Tatanka is long overdue. Luckily, today we have James Horncastle.
Hello.
Gabriele Marcotti.
Hello.
And Richard Hughes.
How are you doing, James?
Very well, thank you. All here to tell us why Il Bisonte was so great. And why it took until after 30 to even arrive in Serie A. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Do you remember that game, Richard?
No, I can't lie and say I remember that game.
It was such a famous game, though. Funnily enough, it was one of those ones that Channel 4 were covering. So it was the day that Princess Diana died and Brescia had a player called Diana, and everyone was focusing on the fact that Ronaldo was debuting and then Recoba, etc. Nobody talks about the fact that the opening goal was Dario Hübner's first ever goal at the age of 30 in Serie A. And it was, do you remember it, Gab? It sounds like this.
Simoni mette dentro l'uruguaiano Alvaro Recoba, 21 anni, arriva dal Nacional di Montevideo, fuori Ganz, ma attenzione, 27esimo, splendida girata di Dario Hübner, che conosce così la Serie A.
There's an 18-year-old looping a beautiful ball over the top of the Inter defence from midfield. I wonder who that was.
Andrea Pirlo.
And controlling it with his knee, turning, spinning and volleying it into the net is this former factory worker, house painter, baker's boy, and a chain cigarette smoker and cereal grappa drinker called Dario Hübner, who is, I mean, it's fair to say, the unlikeliest capocannoniere Serie A has ever had. Is that fair?
I'd probably say so, yeah. I mean, look, he was a massive Inter fan as well. So, yeah, to make his Serie A debut in front of 75,000 at San Siro at the age of 30 and score... under the curva, where, you know, he was a big Spilo Altobelli fan. That was his sort of role model when he was growing up. Stuff that dreams are made of, Jimbo.
Absolutely. As he puts it, and then, of course, Recoba ruined my party by scoring a brace. Gab.
Everything about him was just so unlikely from... I mean, you mentioned the drinking and the smoking, which, you know, maybe... It was exaggerated a little bit. You know, Roberto Pruzzo also used to famously smoke, as did your mate Beppe Signori. But he probably still does. But it was just more the fact that here's a guy who, he grew up near Trieste, which is still, you know, Triestina falling on a hard time, but it's still a professional football team. There's not many people there. For those who don't know, it's, you're just stuck on the very edge of Italy, right? Near the border with Slovenia and Croatia. And he played football and he scored a lot of goals at youth level in his tiny village team. And then in normal circumstances, what happens is a scout says, oh, look, that big lad, he scores a lot of goals and maybe, you know, we'll give him a trial, right? I mean, I'm assuming that's what happens, right, Richard Hughes?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, but in Italy more so than any other country. I don't know, maybe because it's a bigger country than most other Europeans. I don't know. But you do seem to get a few stories of players blossoming late, as you're describing here.
And here... it just didn't happen. It didn't happen until he was
really first pro contract.
No, it was final, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, where you know where his manager?
Well, that's what I was going to get to. Uh-huh. So I've always it's not like it was my life's obsession to ask him, but with hindsight, given I spent more than enough time speaking to him, I probably should ask Guidolin, like, how did you find this guy?
Yeah,
because, you know, 22 is a certain age. Guidolin isn't really from there, but not that far away from there. how you find this guy who just goes and just bowls people over and just scores a lot of goals at a very low level. And as you said, he'd had a whole range of jobs. I think I'm right in saying he had a high school sort of professional degree in carpentry.
Yeah, which like Jesus. He says that he got that because he said to the teachers, I am leaving for the factory tomorrow, so you can give me the diploma or not. And they said, okay, you can have it. And then he left, I think, at the age of 14 to work, first of all, in an aluminium
kind of fitting
factory. And then, then he made doors.
Yeah.
And the expression was that di giorno costruisce porte di sera le sfonda. You know, porte meaning both doors and goals. And so he would build them up by day. And then evening, when he'd go and play for his local side, he'd smash them down. But he slipped through the net. And Nedo Sonetti, who I'm sure is not necessarily a figure that we would all think of as a visionary of Italian football, says that the fact that he arrived in Serie A so late and only had, I think, three seasons in the top flight is a defeat for all of Italian managers. And every time Italian managers saw him and the years he spent in, you know, Serie C, Serie B, they should regard that as essentially a defeat for their way of doing things.
Yeah, I think that's fair as well. I think, as I said there to Gab, in Italy, I think more than any other country, I can think of plenty of examples of players blossoming late. I don't know whether it's a good level of tactical knowledge, even from a grassroots level, perhaps, that so that when they have to climb through the leagues, they do so with more ease. Even a Champions League winning Juventus team with people like Di Livio and Torricelli and people like that who could arguably not have made it. Mm. And particularly when we're looking at bombers in particular and strikers that have scored goals at a lower level, but then seem to be able to find the back of the net even in Serie A.
It comes back to strikers being self-taught or being about instinct rather than,
for example,
Arsene
Wenger. Well, but he's made this point many times.
Rather than being about being told where to go, what moves to make, another sort of great striker of that era and of this genre, if you like, is Igor Perotti.
Right, and they share something very special.
In that they are the only guys who've ever been top scorer in the third division, the second division, and the top flight. But Perotti famously went to play with Beppe Signori at Lazio. Their manager was Zdenek Zeman. And it just didn't work for Perotti, not only because he had Signori in front of him, but because Zeman was very tactical, said you have to make these kind of moves. And normally we've seen strikers excel because of that.
I think Richard hit it on the head, though, which is, I think one of our failings in Italy is we're so big on teaching and tactics and stuff like that. And we get certain ideas in our head. I think this is part of the reason we're so obsessed with foreigners and only recently are they giving homegrown players a chance that we're more likely to see the negatives, right? And what a player cannot do. And we see this all the time. We see teams get promoted. They have these guys, you figure nobody's ever heard of them. They're all going to go down. They must all be terrible, right? And then that doesn't happen. In fact, what we're seeing more recently from promoted teams in Serie A is they're saying, you know what? I don't need to buy, 20 guys with Serie A experience who are just going to be expensive and overvalued. I think back, right, this is going to be a bit niche, but remember a few years ago when Catania came up and they had this ridiculous...
Argentine colony?
No. Before that, they had, when they had Giorgio Corona.
Oh, yeah.
The ridiculous guy who tucked his shorts into his underwear and he had the hair and he was from the deep south. And I thought, this guy's a freak show. Why is he even here, right? I thought, other than Mascara, none of these people can play. And even Mascara had a lot of major issues, right? Mm. But then you realize that I think he scored like 8 or 9 goals that year. He did his part. And I think a lot of it is they just don't look. They don't see the talent. They just think a striker has to be a certain way. Hubner, of course, I don't even think he was that strong. When he jumped, he rarely got off the ground, you know.
He was a big guy.
He's a big dude, but he's not like, he's not Luca Toni, who's much more of an athlete than he is.
But it's funny because Brescia let him go for Luca Toni, and then he goes to Piacenza and outscores Toni and becomes the oldest ever capocannoniere.
Until
at the
Toni
time.
Did it again
Until
at
Toni
Verona.
Did it at 38. Yeah. So what he wasn't, you don't feel he was the strongest? Because that was kind of his defining characteristic, that kind of head down, ploughing forward, ploughing through defences. What marked him out, do you think, Richard?
Well, therefore, his nickname, Bisonte the Bison, that's what he was. He was a big, big sort of target man, a little bit of a different type of striker to most others in Italy. Almost, I dare say, xenophobic, but a British-style striker, if you like. I think he had that nose, as James H has said, that nose to be at the right place at the right time, the ability to find the back of the net. And I think that's what set him apart, and he matured as he got older, and he knew how to trouble defences, even in environments that you're depicting there, like San Siro. Even when I remember seeing him play in his time as Cesena and Brescia, he seemed to be very different from other Italian bomberists. He wasn't your typical bomber di provincia. Protti was a little bit smaller, Signori, Baiano, Tovaglieri, people that were a little bit more nimble and sharp, whereas he was different in his physical presence, and that's why his nickname was what it was, the Bison.
Well, yeah. Right, I mean, the defending in that era, just about the toughest place you could try and goals.
You talk about the year when he was capocannoniere in Serie A, when he shared that title with David Trezeguet. I mean, this is David Trezeguet, a World Cup European Championship winner.
Am I right he didn't take a single penalty that
No,
year?
He didn't. There's no penalties at all. So the backstory there is, he gets into Serie A finally, 1997, the game we mentioned, with Brescia. But they go down. I mean, he scores, I think, 20 goals that year. Scores on that opening day against Inter. Scores a hat-trick the following weekend against Sampdoria and continues to score. But Brescia go down. And nobody comes in for him. But I guess they all feel he's one of those kind of one-season wonders.
Well, legend has it he always liked to be within driving range of his home in Crema. So he never wanted to go too far away.
No, more than 40 kilometres.
He could finish his morning training session, drive back for lunch, and then go back for the afternoon session.
Well, for whatever reason, he stays with Brescia, spends 2 years in Serie B again, gets them back up, and that's when they bring in Baggio, and everyone says, wow, are you excited to be playing with Baggio? And he says, well, to be fair, I've always scored goals anyway, so I don't mind. So you've got Baggio in there, and Carletto Mazzoni is the manager. And they have a brilliant season. The end of that, though, Brescia decide they're going to go with Iglitari and Luca Toni and let him go to Piacenza for 1.5 million. He's now 34 at the start of this season, and that's when he has this extraordinary campaign.
And he can't stop scoring whenever he faces Brescia as well. Scores some brilliant goals, some bicycle kicks. Again, because like these guys, you always associate that genre of player, the bomba di provincia, as guys who, you know, score with their shins, score with their knees, you know, it comes off their backside, off their shoulders, whatever. But there's some goals that he came up with in that season where show a real deftness, a real kind of great technique, you know, sort of lobbing the goalkeeper from outside the box, you know, it going in off the bar, scoring free kicks from long distance, but which he never got to do at Brescia.
Al quarantesimo, una lunga emozione. Caccia ispira Hübner, solo come non dovrebbe essere. Il numero su Cordoba e poi la replica su Milanese, il tiro vale il 2-0 per il Piacenza. Per Hübner, goal number 21 in campionato, è sempre più solo al comando della classifica.
I'm going to posit this as a theory, and I wonder if you share it, Richard. And if you don't, you don't have to be polite. You can just tell me. It's nonsense. In Italy, we have this sense that if you try something difficult, and Giorgio Corona, right, not that I'm obsessed with him, but bring him up again. If you try something difficult, like a long-range shot or like an overhead kick or lobbing the keeper like that, you know, and you get it wrong, you know how like in England, like the crowd goes, ooh, you know. Whereas in Italy, they get angry with you and your teammates say, you know, they have this expression like, you know, fare il fenomeno, like, you know, who you think you are, like trying to do that. And I remember speaking to Gianluca Vialli about this, and he was allowed to do it. Mancini was allowed to do it. But like, even other very good players they played with. He told me once, Toninho Cerezo tried an overhead kick, for example, and people were like rumbling, well, who does he think he is? And I'm like, I'm sorry, he's only Cerezo, Brazilian international. Like, and Hübner, maybe in his formative years, he never had that because he played on these terrible teams where he was the Ibrahimovic of the situation. And he never had anybody telling him, like, oh, you know, don't attempt something difficult. I mean, did you experience that? Did you ever try, like, an overhead kick and has somebody said like use a cazzofai except more with a
beep. Yeah, no, I didn't in answer to that question, but I do agree with you in the fact in, for me, Italian crowds, Italian footballing followers, all very opinionated, and they are in most countries, I guess, but they analyse the game to levels that I don't think other countries, well, healthy. Can't say it for definitely to levels of healthiness which are questionable. But I think because everyone reasons so much about the game and talks so much about the game, whether it's the person in the street or the player out there doing it, people expect good decisions to be made. And normally you've got your fantasista, so it's we're saying Farid Phenomen or know your role, as we would say over here. My role, get it and give it to the phenomenal, if that's the way the team plays. So there might be something to it that Hubner was growing up always the best player in the team, like I was, believe it or not, when I was actually growing up to then, when I was 6 or 7, this was, by the way. But then by the time I got into a team that was composed of better individuals than me, I had to make my sort of niche area something different. So I think there could be mileage in that he was allowed to express himself. And one player in the team, almost as you're alluding to there, Gab, is almost allowed to do it with the number 10, the fantasista, even though Hubner was definitely not that. But clearly, at whatever level he was playing growing up, he was allowed to try the spectacular and maybe get away with it.
Mm. Well, that's different here. I mean, people will try to be more... If on your team you see one of the... I'm not going to name names, but if you see like your central midfielder occasionally try and do stuff that like your skill players or your more skillful players normally do... Unless he doesn't do it all the time or doesn't do it in a stupid way, you're not going to have a go at him, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair generally. I mean, I would, because I'm Italian upbringing. Okay. Yeah, so I'm seeing it like the person.
Hey, your boss wouldn't.
No, I think, yeah, perhaps there's a little bit more of sort of allowing creativity and expression. In generally speaking, I think it's a fair point, Gab. Yeah, so you gave me the opportunity to disagree with you, and I'm not going to.
I suppose if you want to recontextualise that in England, mm-hmm. You know, the mind goes back to Roberto Mancini going off on one at Mario Balotelli in that, what was it, that pre-season friendly when he
That's
tried?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a perfect encapsulation of what Gab's saying.
Mario Balotelli used to go to the Rigamonti to watch Dario Hubner. He said, bring it neatly back to Dario Hubner, who was, to be fair, whoever had been in the team with him, I feel he would have just done his own thing, because he was always extremely a man of his own mind. And there's that great story that Carlo Ancelotti tells about when, after the season, when he's been capocannoniere, the top scorer in Serie A, he doesn't get the call up for the Italy squad for that World Cup in 2002. But what he does get is an invitation to travel to America with Milan and Carlo Ancelotti, and possibly with a view to take on a kind of squad role with the Rossoneri, but it doesn't quite work out, Gab.
Yeah, so this was Ancelotti's first... I think he took over from Fatih Terim in October, November of the previous year. So obviously they had a lot of players who were going to the World Cup and whatnot. It was pretty customary back then for Italian clubs. And this was the end of season tour. It wasn't really the preseason tour. So nobody wanted to be there. Kind of like, all right, we're just doing this for money. It's not like, you know, the glamour of the ICC today. He goes on this tour, and a lot of the players are like, all right, this guy's just not one of us. And it was obviously he's not a different team, but like, he just lives on a different plane. Like, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't look like a footballer. He's older. He's, you know, and again, I don't want to make it seem like he's an alcoholic who's chain smoking, but, you know. At the Milan of that time,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing.
The Milan Lab Milan.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of thing was frowned upon. And, you know, they treated it as if like, oh, like he's just kind of here for a jolly. But that's okay, because, you know, so are we.
He's caught by Ancelotti having a fag during the halftime break. And Carlo asked him what he's doing, because this is a big opportunity. This is the way the story is told anyway. And Dario replies, well, I'm just here basically because I didn't have anything else to do. And would you like a cigarette, mister?
Yeah, and Hubner, it must be said, has refuted this story.
Oh, is he?
He said, like, if, you know, think about it from my point of view, I get a chance to prove myself for a couple of weeks with AC Milan. First, it might be my last big contract, even though I think, you know, he's 35. They're only going to give him, what, a year deal or something like that. Would I have acted like that? No. But, yeah, certainly all these stories about him, you know, smoking his way through the Saturday into the Monday before kickoff, having a cigarette at halftime and then finishing it off at full time with a grappa, you know, all that sort of thing.
Legend.
Ancelotti's also refuted that story.
Ancelotti.
Well. Yeah. That, you know, wasn't quite, but he's like, but, you know, it's a plausible story.
It could have happened. It could have happened. Well, yeah. And in the health consciousness, the then extremely health conscious, and I imagine still to this day health conscious, Serie A, he really was an extraordinary. And it is a shame, Richard, that we didn't get to see more of him, no? I mean, 34.
Yeah, it is a shame. Yeah, I just wonder what makes a Bomber di Provincia remain a Bomber di Provincia. You know, there's so many examples of players that...
Well, snobbism sometimes, I think.
Yeah, perhaps. And in Hoopner, that's why he is a classic Bomber di Provincia. So you've got other people like Christian Vieri and Pippo Inzaghi started off and could have been that had they not become greats of the game.
And we mentioned Protti before. He did get his chance immediately after he got the title of going to Lazio. Tovelieri, who kind of was a similar figure down at Bari, then got a move to Roma.
Actually, I think those are interesting examples, because I'd argue somebody like Pippo Inzaghi, and to a lesser degree Christian Vieri, who improved technically at a much older age, those are people who maybe, had they not had a shot at the big time, and obviously Inzaghi going to Parma, they might have remained that way, you know, because they were not particularly technically gifted players, you know, in terms of the very highest level.
Just coming back to what you said earlier, sorry, Gab, it's when if you're looking at what players can't do, Inzaghi is the class. If I got scouts to, like, say, go and watch Inzaghi, is he quick? No. Is he good technically? No. Is he strong? No. Is he good heading it? No. It's like, well, why are you bringing this player? But you put it all together, you focus on what you said earlier, on what he is good at, and you've got one of the greats of the game.
Mm. But that's a great story that Paolo Maldini tells, that in the kind of Patitella, the game that they would have in training, they would be looking at Pippo and they'd be like, God, this guy can't trap a ball.
Yeah, Di Matteo says the same thing at the Azzurri, that with the first time he turned up there, they were probably as gobsmacked as Milan were when Hoopner turned up on the Torneo Estivo.
I've got an Inzaghi story.
Go on.
When I was at in the Primavera, so I was like 17 at the time, and Mondonico was the manager, and he would call over the youth team to play against the Primavera, to play against the first team on a Wednesday or a Thursday before the Sunday game. And for some reason, he wanted me to man mark Inzaghi, and this happened a couple of times, maybe because I was maybe slightly bigger than the other one, so he wanted me to try and, in inverted commas, rough him up a little bit. And playing against Inzaghi, who had two other very good companions either side of him, so Domenico Morfeo and Gigi Lentini.
Wow.
Who put it on a plate. And I used to come back and I would tell my dad, who was always very interested in what happened in training, I was like, oh, man marked Inzaghi. And bear in mind, Inzaghi's good at this time. He'd been to Parma, he was scoring goals for Atalanta, but he wasn't the great he became. And he goes, oh, how do you go on? I goes, oh, yeah, did really well. He didn't get a kick and he got a hat-trick. But you know, and literally the goals were, it would be a penalty that Morfeo would have it rebounded, hit his knee and go in. Another one that was marginally offside, it'd come off me and then ricochet off Inzaghi. But this wasn't a coincidence. This happened every week, and it was very deflating for this poor young Scottish kid man-marking this player, thinking he was doing a good job, and he was just scoring goals galore.
Jeez, but Morfeo and Lentini.
What players? Yeah, particularly, yeah. I mean, Lentini's well-known, but Morfeo was one of those that, sorry to veer off scent in the bottom of the Provincia, but Morfeo, I mean, how many chances did he get at making it? He could have for every top team.
Morfeo's one of those guys that you look back and you think, he could have been in sort of the Baggio, Zola, Mancini, great number 10, the Del Piero, great number 10 class. But as we say in Italy, you know, non aveva testa, right?
Absolutely.
The case, but, you know, he wasn't
nothing
right
between
in the head
ears.
And, you know.
Yeah. Well, Lentini as well is a story. The man who Berlusconi broke the bank for and invited the wrath of the opprobrium of the papacy, for such was the size of the fee that Milan paid Torino to prize him away. And that's just the figure that they admitted, not counting the hotel in Baldonecchia that was... under the table. But then the extraordinary story of how that all went wrong, involving Mrs. Schillaci, that unless that one isn't true as well,
and crashing the Ferrari while driving it at like 180 kilometers.
Yeah, on his way back from seeing Rita Schillaci.
Yeah. This is with the, because he'd had a flat tire, so he'd put the little sort of donut, the one that where it says, like, you know, caution, do not drive at more than 30 miles an hour.
Yeah,
and you're only supposed to drive, you know, far enough to get it changed, and 180 miles.
Was this before he saw her or after?
No, this is on the way back.
On the way, so maybe Schillaci got home and
to make a quick getaway.
So, but that's a tale for another day. Okay, anything else about Dario Hubner? Why is he such a legend? Because he's like the fans, a guy who rolls his sleeves up, works, enjoys a drink.
Yeah, and I think there's one at every local club. I mean, I'm not going to mention, well, Andrea Mastropaolo was the one that when I was growing up in Peschiera Borromeo, and he was the local one, if there was a player that was going to blossom late and play in Serie A. So I think a lot of people can maybe not relate to necessarily, because he went on and scored in goals of a very high level. But everyone, you know, everyone could have been a player. They could have been. I'm not belittling what he had to offer, but the fact that it looked as if he wouldn't have a top-level career did so late, I think that's part of the something that makes him so endearing.
Could you make a comparison between, say, Dario Hubner and Jamie Vardy?
you could, and I think people have done that. I think Vardy may be a little bit younger. The guy I was thinking of is Glenn Murray.
Okay.
Because this is a guy who, you know, he played for the Carolina Railhawks or some such nonsense in the U.S. and had all sorts of issues, has a big issue now, of course. And then he gets to the Premier League and you think this guy's rubbish, and he is kind of rubbish, and then he starts scoring goals, and then he starts scoring goals again. And he shouldn't be playing for Brighton because he's, like you said, he's probably, other than the goalkeepers, he's probably worse than every other person on the Brighton team at actually touching the ball, and right?
As a former Bournemouth player, I can't agree with you this time, but I'm not stopping you from saying
He played for Bournemouth?
He played for Bournemouth.
I had no idea. So. But not in the top flight.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he scored that great goal when we won at Chelsea 1-0, and he scored the winner, the head of the back post.
All right, but he's still kind of, you know what I mean? Like, no, but he scored a lot of goals relative to the ability.
Okay, so the Glenn Murray.
I was jesting about not interrupting you this time.
Okay, right. But you know what I mean? Like, he has that ability. He gets in a position. He's got, whether it's the brains or the instinct, right? So he's 32 now, right?
Yeah.
Something like stupid like that.
And if he did that, and if he was top scorer in the Premier League, and the Premier League had Turam and who else, and Maldini and all the greats,
Montero.
This was the great thing.
That would be the comparison, effectively.
One of the anecdotes of Natel's is that one of the best moments of his career, a guy came up to him after a game and said, "Can I have your shirt?" And that guy was Paolo Maldini.
There you go. So anyway, Daddy Hubner, they should have taken him to the, they took Del Vecchio instead, who never had a kick at the 2002 World Cup. Not that it would have made any difference, because Baro Moreno
should have taken Baggio as well. You know?
Yeah,
you know,
some anti-Brescia bias
because
there.
Del Vecchio is exactly like one what Richard said earlier about, you know, our thinking is we like the guys who make the right movements on the pitch, mm-hmm. and are tactically disciplined and work hard and blah blah blah. Del Vecchio is that, you know.
What's his name? Trillia.
No, but the number
the
of
trout.
Italian managers
yeah, that's
who,
what they called him.
Who obsess, right? Yeah. And they get all excited and, you know, Del Vecchio basically gives them a hard-on. When you look at him, and if Del Vecchio had been born in Brazil, well, would he be playing? I mean, would he be playing professional football, presumably? But
he'd be kicked off the beach. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, this is a different, right? He's the guy who does everything that people want of him.
Yeah.
And then they overlook somebody like Hubner. I'm sure there's some sort of happy medium between the Del Vecchios and the...
Yeah.
Am I being too harsh on him?
No. Well, Del Vecchio, he formed an interesting partnership with Totti and Montella. Yeah.
But that's what I mean, right?
Yeah.
You've got the guy who scores, you've got the genius who doesn't run, and then you've got this dude, like, basically... working his rear end off for him, right?
I mean, he's exactly the same now as he did then. You know,
He's
never really aged, Del Vecchio. He's just like this rake-like figure with... what looks like dyed jet black hair, but it's still the same long hair.
Hubner,
life goals for me.
Hubner, it looks more or less the same, but a bit greyer.
Mm.
Just bringing it once again back to Hubner. One last Hubner story, James.
Well, there's this kind of story that he put a lot of his money into a bar, and he would wait tables and be the guy behind the bar. He would be the barman, but that's all. A myth as well.
Oh,
it kind of says, but it
one
says a lot.
True story,
but does it not say a lot about someone that these myths created around someone? Which, you know, he basically lives a much more normal life than people give him credit for. But, you know, but I think people project what they want onto this kind of this figure of Hubner, which is.
Mm. Yeah. I'll give you one.
All right.
So there's a town called Monticelli d'Ongina, which is the garlic capital of the world. It's true. It's twinned with a town in California called Gilroy. And they have this annual, or biannual actually, garlic festival. It alternates between Gilroy and Monticelli. And when he was at Piacenza one year, and I would have told the story earlier, I couldn't remember what it was, but they had some celebrity was supposed to come and open it and kind of, you know, do like the ribbon cutting and moderate celebrity. You know, it's a town of 6,000 people, but we're very proud of our garlic. And then this person couldn't come. There's fog in Milan. If I couldn't come in or whatever. So they literally called Dario Udine, who was training that morning at Piacenza. And they said, you want to come by this afternoon and do this? And he's like, yeah, no problem. And he just sort of showed up, did the ribbon cutting. And he left with two baskets of garlic.
Bingo. All right.
It was the inspiration for I would say, a very bad song a few years ago. Is again just all
the
about.
Summer of Hubner.
The Summer of Hubner.
You went there. Oh my word. Well, let's have a little bit of the Summer of Hubner. to play us out of this little section before we have a quick chat about what's coming up this weekend.
Rich, is your garlic sauce from there? Because you are a restaurateur as well as a...
Well, if it's not, it will be now. Either that or in Gilroy somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Those restaurants, by the way, Mele Peri, and the other one's called is Gotto?
Yeah, Gotto.
Gotto,
yeah.
Is very, very nice. That's if you happen to be wandering by the canal out by Stratford. But what I actually wanted to quickly touch on before we get kicked out is... what's happening in the current world of Italian football? There's the cup final going on this evening, which kind of limits us from talking too much about it. So Milan take on Juventus in what is effectively the last big occasion of Gigi Buffon's career.
Yeah, his first Coppa Italia final since 99.
Really?
Because basically, even though they've been to the final, they've won this competition in the last 3 years. It's always been the stand-ins job. That's the, you know, the big prestige game that he'll get. You know, your Marco Stilladis, your Nettos and that sort of thing. So I think it's a nod that this will be Gigi's last big occasion. So, from that point of view, it's a big game. And then also from Milan's point of view, and this goes into the weekend as well, if Milan were to win tonight, they can obviously qualify for the Europa League, which I think is the minimum.
Financial fair play permitting.
Exactly. And but if they don't win tonight, well, their next two games are essentially Europa League playoffs against Atalanta and against Fiorentina, who are chasing qualification for that competition as well.
And a really interesting situation still with the... battle for top four places. Obviously, the title race looks pretty much sorted now. Juve, 6 points clear of Napoli with two games to go. But Inter, Lazio and Roma in reverse order, effectively Roma in third place. Lazio currently taking the last Champions League spot and Inter 2 points behind them.
Can I posit something?
Yeah.
I think it might be my second posit of the show.
Uh-huh.
So Roma are hosting Juventus.
Yeah.
And you have a situation where Roma need a point to be guaranteed Champions League football.
Right.
Juventus need a point.
So a point is enough in one of their two remaining games, a point is enough to guarantee Roma the top four.
Yeah. But what's interesting is I think until a few years ago, we would have been going, obvious biscotto, right? I mean, you know, it's a draw.
Even against Juventus?
Well, that's the thing. And I think the whole mindset's changed. I mean, watching Torino play last week, I was talking to somebody who knows Mazzarri well. And Mazzarri was kind of surprised at how hard they played and they kept going when Torino has nothing to play for. And in general, the whole environment is grim, largely because also Mazzarri's there and tends to bring everybody down. But, I don't know. I just get a sense that even though, you know, I'm sure the price on the draw is very, very low. I get a sense that this is going to be a real game.
Mm.
And they're actually going to go for it. And then... who knows? And maybe Juve will need to wait till Verona to win their title.
Right. Fatal Verona. We shall see.
What a story would that be, huh?
Well, that would be amazing. And of course, equally intriguing is the final day clash between Inter and Lazio, which could well be a spareggio for that Champions League spot.
Yeah, it looks like it now because Lazio dropped points in a very good game against Atalanta at the Olimpico, where they look to be hanging on, really. And it's to be understood. Understandable, really, given that Lazio, I think, have played more games than anybody else this season.
And the injuries. Right?
And the injuries as well that piled up. Yeah.
By the way, Liverpool fans, I know you only got a fleeting glimpse of your Luis Alberto, but he's been absurdly good this year.
Yeah. The revelation of the season, no?
Yeah, I'd say certainly for Lazio. And so you won't see him against Inter because he's out. But.
Unless there's some kind of record recovery, these guys, you know, sort of the knife between the teeth.
Yeah. Atalanta still in with a shout, though. Richard, your old club?
Yeah, they are. I mean, that draw, again, that really good game that James is talking about there against Lazio, actually the draw really suits neither team because Lazio now have got it all to do in the last two games, particularly that spareggio against Inter. And Atalanta have this must-win game, must hope that Milan lose tonight, first and foremost, And because that would mean that if they did get fifth place, sixth place, beg your pardon, yeah, you're right, then that would mean a direct entry in the group stages, and no one wants to be sort of going to Eastern Europe for their summer pre-season tours. So yeah, huge game for Atalanta, and then of course the Cagliari game on the last day of the season, right. And Cagliari, by the looks of things, could need more.
Well, yeah, that's
need something. Yeah.
So there's five teams within 2 points of each other down at the bottom. Spal on 35, Crotone, Udinese, and Chievo a point behind them, and then Cagliari, who are currently in the third relegation spot, along with Verona and Benevento, have already gone. Just a point further back. So yeah. Wow. All right. Well, everything to play for, apart from the title. Probably.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick point on Atalanta.
Yeah.
Usually, when a team like Atalanta qualify for Europe, they're stretched. Because their squad isn't big enough and all that. But I think they've done a really good job of having a sporting director who kept Chievo where Chievo should never have been for a long, long time, and have that academy. And they've got a freshness about them at this stage of the season, even after getting into the knockout stage of the Europa League, after knocking Napoli out of the Coppa Italia. Which is pretty remarkable. And this kid they've again found from their academy, Musa Bado, who can't stop scoring, looks like the next baby phenomenon, you know? He looks pretty special.
Mm. Almost looking at him.
No, I said last time I was on that we would never sign another Atalanta player. There can only be one Atalanta-Bournemouth connection. But not just that, it's the fact that it worries me significantly, and I've told this to the people at Atalanta, the fact that they keep on producing these players. They're very well managed. The club's very well run. I'm just not sure that buying them at top price and then expecting them to deliver in a different environment is good value for money.
Because the club is so well organised.
Yeah, and the way Gasperini plays is so particular. Mm. So you see people like Gagliardini had an unbelievable half a season before Inter signed him for 30-something. He's a decent player, but...
It is odd. This is one thing I'll say about, you know, the never-ending sort of nature versus nurture debate. Atalanta, nobody's arguing, one of the top academies in all of Europe in terms of the sheer volume of professionals. But if you ask yourself, who is the last superstar who lived up to billing that Atalanta produced? And I know, obviously, Morfeo could have been that, but you probably have to go back to Donadoni.
Yeah,
and that was a long, long... Yeah. I mean, maybe Caldara, we'd all love it if he did, but, like, you know, that... It's odd. Like, they produce a lot of top-level, very good Serie A players. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actual stars, it's... And I think that's because, ultimately, you know, sorry to disappoint the nurture brigade, but stars are born. You know, there's a randomness to it.
Well, there you go. And on that thought-provoking note from Gabriele Marcosi, it's what we bring to an end this edition of Golato. We will return next week. Maybe we'll have a look forward to that final day Lazio-Inter playoff. Trying to think if there's ever been a big Lazio-Inter showdown on the final day with anything riding on
it.
Well, we'll have a look. We'll do a bit of research and see if anything springs to mind. Yeah. But for now, many, many thanks, Rich, for being with us this evening.
Again,
hope the end of the season goes well for you and the Cherries and James Horncastle and Gab Marcotti and you, listener. See you next week. For now, from all of us here, arrivederci.
You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.